You know, whenever I read the early readings, the first couple of chapters from the book of Genesis, I often think about the man naming the various animals and the wild, you know, creatures that crawl through the ground and fly through the air. I think about when my brother-in-law, when my nephew was first learning how to form words, trying to understand the English language, and his father, my brother-in-law, was teaching him all those useful words because it was one of those phenomenons. My brother-in-law taught my nephew that everything with wings and flies was a duck. It didn't matter if it was a chicken or a goose or a hare, it was everywhere a duck. They're all ducks. And if it had four legs, it was a dog. It didn't matter if it was a horse or a dog or a cat, they were all dogs. So we had dogs and we had ducks, and that's what we had. It led to some fascinating conversations like, my sister spent the entire day riding a horse on dog today, and we think, that sounds exhausting for the dog, but, you know, sure. I mean, we'll ignore the fact that it was, in fact, a pony, but, you know, well, you know, it was a dog. You know, it's a dog, it's a duck. I'd point out and say, look, turkeys. And he'd say, duck. And I'd go, no, turkey. And then we'd have an argument, because it's always fun to have an argument with a three-year-old. But I think about that when I read Genesis. I'm always fascinated by it, especially when, you know, God brings these animals to the man, and the man names them. I always wonder if there was a bit of a discussion, you know, like, what's this? It's a duck. Great, it's a duck. Send it on its way. What's this? It's a duck. No, the last one was a duck. This has got to be something new. It's a flying duck. No, come on, we can do better than that. I don't know, maybe, you know, just too childish when I think about it, but I think about these things. I read this early reading from Genesis, realize that we're in the second chapter of Genesis. It's the second creation story. We have two creation stories in Genesis. Chapter 1 is a creation. Chapter 2 is a creation, again told, from a different viewpoint, in a different style. And in this version, in the second version, we see man. We see man first, and what does God say? He says, it's not good for man to be alone. He experiences loneliness. He is unfulfilled by himself. God made him in his image and likeness. He made him after himself. God actually does not want to be alone. We talk about the Trinity within God. We talk about Father, Son, Holy Spirit within God. There, he's never alone. He actually has this beautiful reflection of love contained in himself. He sees man, and man, and it's not good for him to be alone. So what does he do? He brings forth all of these animals. He brings forth cattle and birds of the air and wild animals. And what happens with each of them? Well, with each of them, the man names them. Ancient tradition, to name something is to declare authority over it. He names it. He declares his power over it. And he calls them by what they are. He doesn't give them a name. He calls them by what they are. And he declares that authority. And that's fine. We're stewards of the earth. We're responsible for the creatures of the land. And we are responsible for these things. But none of them are partners for him. All of them are a power relationship. He's the steward. And they're the creature that he commands. Now, go home and try and tell your dog what to do. Maybe he'll do some of it. He probably won't do all of it. Tell him to do long division. He'll just stare at you for a long time. But there is this commanding, this authority that's declared. But none of them are partners. And so God, through the literary device of Genesis, we get this notion of God casting sleep on the man and taking the rib and closing it up. And then he makes the woman. And the woman is alone. And I know the woman is alone first because it actually says, then he brought her to the man. She didn't start next to him. She experienced being alone. She also experienced the incompleteness. And she was brought to the man. And what does the man say? And this is where an English translation breaks down for us very quickly because we use the same verb, even though he actually doesn't use the same verb in the original translation. And God brings the woman to the man, and the man actually says, this one is bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. This one is woman. He doesn't name her. He recognizes her. He actually sees her instead of trying to declare power over her. And so it is that they have this equality. He says, this one is of me, and I am of her. And he recognizes that right foot. And that was the way it was supposed to be. This beautiful recognition that as we are made in the image and likeness of God, so we reflect this Trinitarian understanding of love. We reflect this beautiful gift of love where we truly actually know ourselves first by knowing us in our alone. And then more fully realizing it in that relationship, in that connection, in the complementarity between two sexes. naturally by coming together in this way, they see something of how they can actually be a gift of love to the other. Because we can't just be a gift of love to ourselves. We cannot really fully receive all of our own love or reciprocate it properly. It gets confused very quickly. In order to actually fully live into love, we have to have an agent, another, who can fully receive our love and extend their love to us in equal measure. How that's expressed might be different between the two members, but the fact that it is this outpouring of love is in fact this equality, and it is the way it's supposed to be. And what does it say? It says, this is how it will be. The man will leave his father and mother and cling to his wife, and there will no longer be two, but one. Just one. And how do you pull apart one? You don't, because it's one. You don't pull it apart. And that's how God intended it. That's how God wanted it to be. So the two become one. And there is no separation between them. We don't experience that separation, but we see that oneness, that beautiful oneness. And we screwed it up because we didn't get it right. It took us only a whole chapter, because in chapter 2 we see how beautiful it is, and in chapter 3 we sin. We wander away from it. We don't necessarily pull it off. We jump ahead to the gospel. And what do we see? We see the Pharisee approaching Jesus, and he's looking to trap him. Because if he's truly to be the Messiah, then he should be able to answer every question perfectly. But of course, the Pharisee is well-versed in Scripture, and he knows all of the conundrums that he and his school of followers have always struggled with, because they're the classic no-answer answers. And so he goes to Jesus and he says, is it lawful? Is it allowed? Is it lawful for the husband to divorce his wife? And he knows that it's a trap, because he knows that Moses allowed for it. You know that Moses gave in and he allowed for it, and if this Messiah, so to speak, says that it's okay, he can point to Moses and say it's okay, but that's not how it was supposed to be, because he can point back to Genesis. And if he says no, then he points back to Genesis, it's not lawful for that to happen, then he can point to Moses and say, well then why did Moses let it happen if Moses is the great giver of the law? Either way, there's no good answer. And so how does Jesus actually respond? Jesus responds with, well, what did Moses tell you? Without endorsing it, he said, what did Moses tell you? And of course, they already know the answer. He knows what they're going to say, but he has to allow them to see it. He says, what did Moses tell you? And he says, well, Moses said that the husband could write a bill of divorce and dismiss her. Jesus said, because it's not the way it was supposed to be. That was not the intention. It's the reality, but it's not the intention. We screwed up. We didn't do it right the first time, or the second, or the third, or I think I'm in the hundreds now in line. But you know, we didn't do it right on the first try, or the many tries following. But God didn't say, well, that was a failed experiment, throw us in the incinerator and call it a day. No, he keeps giving us this chance to go pan back to him. He keeps inviting us back to step into that life of God, to step into the great reality of what it is that he wants to offer. He keeps inviting us back, and he even recognizes that two should become one. But the fact of the matter is that for a marriage to work, the two have to become one. Both have to be fully committed to the other. And so it is that we experience divorce in our world. Because sometimes it's not the way it was supposed to be. Sometimes it does break down. Because in order for marriage to work, two people have to be committed to it. And if one or both of them is not fully committed to it, then it isn't there. So it is we have divorce. And in the church, we talk about a declaration of nullity, more often referred to as an annulment, and that's not the same thing. I always think it's important we remember from time to time that an annulment is not a Catholic divorce. That's not how this works. That's not how we identify this. Actually, a declaration of nullity is to say that the two did not become one, because it does require that full commitment of both in order for that to happen, and if it's missing, then the sacrament isn't actually there. And please understand, it's just because someone is granted an annulment or has an annulment does not declare any kind of illegitimacy to their children. Their children are as legitimate as they've always been. It does not some kind of a dissolve that suddenly disappears in that moment. That's not how that happens. It's also very important for us to remember that it is not divorced Catholics who are denied communion. It's divorced and remarried Catholics who are supposed to receive we're supposed to go through the tribunal office to work that out so that they can come back into full communion with the faith. We actually don't want to cast anybody out. That's never been the goal. That's not how we want to do this. Actually, we want to always have God's mercy available to as many people as possible to bring in that greater life of Christ, to bring in that greater reality of God who wants to give us these good things. And why do we do this way? Well, unfortunately, we came apart. Jesus points out, he says, the two are supposed to become one flesh. This is how we're supposed to be. What do we do instead? Well, it's not here in today's reading, but it's the third chapter of Genesis is what we did. We had a whole chapter where we actually, everything came together and it was beautiful. And by the end of the chapter, we had managed to screw it up. So, you know, who knows how long that took, but we managed to come apart. And we picked a fight with each other. We did. If you think about it, it's actually right there at the end of chapter 3, because what happens is here in Genesis 2, the two become one flesh, and they're one, and it's great. And then in chapter 3, we sin, and we disobey God, and we eat of the fruit, and we're cast out of the garden, and we find ourselves separated. And after trying to blame anyone and everyone except ourselves and accept our responsibility, we try and push it off on each other. And it fascinates me, because it happens right there. At the end of chapter 3, we pick the big fight. We do. Because at the end of chapter 3, it says, the man named his wife Eve. And he picked a fight with his wife. Because he tried to name her. He tried to declare authority over her. And he gave her a name. He named the animals, he declared his authority over them. And now he's trying to name his wife. And he introduces a power struggle. And of course, now we have this great power struggle where we're trying to battle for some kind of supremacy. We're trying to battle for some kind of stronger will or greater victory or so many things. And it all comes from our inability to do it right the first time. Never underestimate what we name. We declare that authority. I mean, consider for a moment parents get to name their children. Why? Because they get to declare authority over their children when they name them, especially as they're raising them. At least you get to think you have authority over them until they turn into teenagers and try and pick fights with you all the time. But, you know, the idea is still that there's this expressed authority. I think that's why Catholics add a middle name, you know, so that you can really express that authority. When they're really in trouble, you can say a first and a second name, you know, just to really bring home that has been named. And the fight begins when the man tries to name his wife. Instead of seeing her as his equal anymore, instead of trying to see that equality, that greater gift of the two of them coming together as one, he tries to pick a fight with her and tries to declare that authority. And so now we find ourselves in this position where we still want to live into God's promise, we still want to live into God's love, we still want to do these things to the best of our ability, but how do we do it? It's not like we can look to our first parents for the good example. They didn't really give us that great of an example. So how do we live into this love? How do we live into this great vocation of this willingness to live into God's plan? Whether we're married or not married, genuinely, how do we live into this to the best of our ability? Well, our model is actually right here in Hebrews. He who for a little while was made lower than the angels. He, Jesus, God himself. God who made all of the angels, who named them because he is in fact God. God who is capable of doing all things, who stands outside of his own creation because while he made all of his creation, it's separate from him. He doesn't need his creation. He who was capable of doing anything was willing to surrender himself and become less than his very creation. He was made lower than the angels and an act of love. If we're to live into our vocation, if we're to live into exactly what it is that Jesus is trying to express to us, this willingness to reflect the image and likeness of God, this most excellent example of who we are in the creation, then we must be willing to humble ourselves out of an act of love. Not just because someone compels us or forces us or coerces us, but willing to humble ourselves as an act of love. So that someone else, the one we love, might receive that greater gift. It comes from that willingness to put aside our own wants, our own desires, our own needs, our own promptings, and place someone else's good in front of that. And in that willingness, in that sacrifice, we live into that more perfect example of love, and we become closer and closer to what God truly intended for us from the very beginning. And that is what we are called to do, is to live into that love in the most perfect way possible. By being willing to to step outside of ourselves and show that willingness to self-sacrifice so that we might see that greater love of God manifest and grow closer to Him with each and every act of love.